This work relates, like we want to understand supersymmetric field theories defined on compact Riemannian manifolds. And in particular, we are interested in trying to understand on what geometrical data these partition functions depend on. So, well, in this audience, there are like many experts on computing properties of supersymmetric field theories on compact Riemannian spaces. And let me just tell that, like, in the last few years, there have been lots of advances. And one particular very famous instance of these developments has been the computation of partition functions for n equal to supersymmetric field theories in three dimensions, put supersymmetrically on the three sphere, or either the round case or other manifolds which are like diffeomorphic to the three sphere but have a different metric. So, for instance, this has been started by Kapustin, Villet, and Yakov, and then like there have been advances by Jefferies, who consider more general theories, and Amos, Omichi, and Lee, who started squashing the sphere in various ways, Imamura, and others. So, let me just remind you of some interesting facts. So, we can consider the round sphere, S3, and then compute the partition function for some n equal to theories, place supersymmetrically on S3. This will give some result. There are also these squash spheres. So there is one squash sphere which has an SU2 times U1 isometry. So S3 has SU2 times SU2. And this one has a more, it's more generic. If one computes the partition function on this sphere, actually, like there are two different ways of placing supersymmetric field theories on these manifolds. One, which was first developed by Amos, Omichi, and Lee, which gives the same result as the round three sphere. And there is another one, which gives some function of B, where B is some squashing parameter which describes the geometry. So B is some squashing parameter. So here we have an instance of like theories put on a manifold which have like the same metric giving two different results. Clearly the way in which the theories are placed supersymmetrically on these manifolds differ. There is also another squash sphere which is which has only a U1 times U1 isometry, also like considered for the first time by Amos, Omichi, and Lee. And in this case you get the same function Z of some squashing parameter here. But the functional dependence of the partition function on the squashing parameter is the same as for the SU2 times U1 case. And finally, it was recently found out that you can actually obtain this function ZB directly from the round case by placing the theory on the round sphere in a different way, which depends on this B. So one question which is natural to ask is, like, what is B? And also, like in principle, what kind of geometrical information can the partition function depend on? So this is the question that I'll try to address. So in this paper, we consider both theories in n equal one theories in four dimensions and n equal two theories in three dimensions. But in this talk, I'll just talk about n equal two theories in three dimensions. In particular, I will consider n equal two theories in three dimensions with a U1 R symmetry. So the superalgebra of these theories is just given by so mu alpha beta p mu plus I epsilon alpha beta z. So where z is the central charge. And all the other commutation relations are zero. Yes. So the sum, like the outline of the talk, is that, well, if we start by reviewing some necessary and sufficient condition to have supersymmetry in curved space, then I will, in particular, I will introduce a geometrical object called the transversely holomorphic foliation, which is the characteristic which, like, the necessary and sufficient characteristic to have supersymmetry for this n equal to theories with a U1R symmetry. And finally, I will consider, like, Z and how it depends on the geometry. Okay. So before continuing, let me just give some general remarks. Suppose you have some theory defined in Euclidean flat space, and then we want to put it on some curved manifold. So one way we can do this is by coupling this theory to gravity, and then setting the metric to be like whatever metric on this manifold we want. And after we do this, we can send M Planck to infinity in such a way that we freeze all the fluctuations of the gravity fields. And what we are left after this procedure is completed is some theory on some on the manifold that like is described by the manifold that we set the metric to. if there is some killing vector on this geometry, then this the diffeomorphisms which like are parameterized by this killing vector will become space-time symmetries of the resulting theory on the manifold. So in the same way, if we start from a theory which is supersymmetric, we can couple it to supergravity. And then we can set the fields in the supergravity fields to like whatever background of our choice. So for first thing, we couple the Sugra. Then we set gravity fields. To background values, which we can do because we can send M Planck to infinity by freezing them into some configuration. And well, the theory that we obtain in this way is not does not have to be supersymmetric. However, if we look at the supergravity variations of the backgrounds that we have chosen, if the supergravity variation is zero, then like the background that we've chosen will be supersymmetric, and the resulting and the Lagrangian that results from this procedure will also will have some supersymmetry. So in the supergravity fields, there are some bosonic fields, and their variation is always proportional to the gravitino. And then there is the variation of the gravitino. So if we set the gravitino to zero, in this case, there are two because we are in an n equal two theory. So if we set the gravitino to zero, then the only thing we have to check in order for the background to be supersymmetric is that on this background, the variation of the gravitino vanishes. So supersymmetry implies that there exists some supergravity variation parameter zeta such that the variation of the gravitino is equal to zero. And well, there is an equivalent condition for the variation of psi tilde. Okay. So if we look at the theory that we write around flat space, so if we consider a manifold which is very large, then we can describe this theory by coupling the supercurrent multiplet of the theory to the gravity multiplet. And this is like the way we are going to proceed. So for, let's see, where should I write? Okay, I think I'll write here. So for this kind of theories, this n equal to theories in three dimensions, whichever U1 are symmetry, the supercurrent lies in a supermultiplet together with other operators. The supermultiplet is called the R multiplet. And it consists of the conserved R current, J mu R. So this is the R current. Then there is a current coming from the central charge. We call this J mu Z. There is also the energy momentum tensor, which lies in the same multiplet. So this is symmetric and conserved. And finally, there is a scalar J, a scalar operator J. So this field, well, and as I said, the supercurrent S alpha mu and S tilde alpha mu, which generate the supersymmetry transformations. So this multiplet can be coupled to one particular off-shell formulation of supergravity in three dimensions, which is called new minimal supergravity. So the fields in this supergravity are, well, there is the metric. So changes in the metric couple to the energy momentum tensor, as usual. Then there is a scalar field H, which is actually an auxiliary field. Then there is the two gravitini, psi mu alpha and psi tilde mu alpha, which couple to the supercurrent around flat base. And finally, we have two gauge fields, one for the R current, we'll call it A mu R. And there is also another one for the central charge current, we'll call it C mu. And often, instead of talking about C mu, we'll use V mu, which is just defined in terms of C mu in the following way. So it's the dual phase strength of C. And by its definition, well, first, the V mu is conserved. OK, so these are all the fields in the supergravity. And well, as you can imagine, the De Lagrangian is just these two fields contracted, these two fields contracted, and so on, in the way that you can imagine. Add that in case the theory that I start with has some, say, abelian flavor symmetry, then I can also couple this flavor symmetry to some background gauge field. And because we are in a supersymmetric field theory, the conserved current will lie in a multiplet. So in this case, it's a linear multiplet. Which contains two scalars, one I call JF and the other K. Then there is the conserved current and fermions. And this multiplet couples to a vector multiplet, which contains a gauge field and two scalars D and sigma. And then there are gaugini here, voila. So and again, the coupling is just JF times D, K times sigma, and so on. OK. So now that we have explicitly what are all the fields that we have in our supergravity theory, we can write down what are the conditions that allow to preserve supersymmetry. So this will be that the variation of the gravitino is zero. And also, if we have this background for a billion Clebsch symmetries, then we want that the variations of this Gaijini are also zero, so that the background that we choose for this vector multiples is supersymmetric as well. So we can write down what these conditions are. And they look a little bit ugly, but they're not too terrible. So first of all, the variation of the gravitino being zero, this means that there must exist some spinor zeta on the manifold such that the following equation is satisfied. Okay, so this is an equation, the differential equation for zeta, and you can see that it only depends on the background that we chosen for the supergravity fields. So it does not depend on the particular theory we consider, it just depends on the background. And there is also, there is an equivalent equation for the variation of psi tilde, which will depend on some spinor zeta tilde. I'm not going to write it down. It's basically very similar to this one, apart from some signs. And finally, we also have delta lambda equals zero. And this is also some pretty not particularly nice looking equation. So this is the field strength of the connection A mu. And then we have something else here. Voila. So everything must be zero. And so if we have one solution to this equation, then this equation has to be satisfied for the same spinor zeta. So each time we have a solution to this equation, we say that the background preserves one supersymmetry with R charge 1, as you can see from the fact that the derivative is twisted with A mu R. And if there is a solution to the other equation coming from delta psi tilde, then we also have another supercharge with the opposite R charge. And so then you can try to classify which manifolds allow for a certain number of solutions to this equation. Whoa. Okay. So for instance, I just give a very simple example. We can consider the round sphere, the round three sphere. And for the round three sphere, we just have to choose h equals minus I over r, where R is the radius of the three sphere, and all the the metric has to be the one of the round three sphere. All the other background fields, mu R, c mu, are zero. And with this choice of H, it turns out that we can solve this equation, and we can find actually two independent solutions for zeta. And we can also find two independent solutions for the equation for psi tilde. So in this case, we have four supercharges. Is there any question?
So some of the background fields are complex, right?
Yes. So because we are working in Euclidean space, there is the spinor zeta and the spinor zeta tilde are not related by complex conjugation. So that means that this equation makes sense also for complex values of the auxiliary fields. So we never consider a complex metric, but we allow the background auxiliary fields, MUR and mu and H, to acquire a complex value. And one interesting point is that, for instance, for the S3, we see that H has a complex value, and H couples to this operator J, which is actually redundant if the theory is superconformal. So then, like, one result is that for a superconformal theory, like, well, you know how to put the superconformal theory on S3, but you recover the result that in that case the action is real. But for a theory which is not superconformal, then this J cannot be set to zero, and then it couples to this imaginary value of H, and this has like various consequences.
You said that some of the auxiliary fields can be complex, but you're saying that in the case of non-conformal series, some of the auxiliary fields must be complex, like this H. Right?
Yeah, this H, if you want to preserve four supercharges on the sphere, then you have to choose H in such a way that it must be that. Right.
So then if I were to think in terms of holographic duals, these constructions, then it would be difficult to realize it as constructions with three here.
Well, then it's real. For CFT, it's real, right?
For the CFT, yeah. For a CFT, there is no problem. H couples to like a background which is a redundant operator.
Non-normalizable components. It's like metric, right? So metric is a non-normalizable mode. When you can start with ADS 52L. So here there are some additional keys. And here we have a complex non-normalizable mode.
So in order to continue and describe like what kind of geometrical structure ensures that we can solve this equation, I have to introduce some machinery. So in particular, I have to tell you something about almost contact metric structure and transverse holomorphic foliations. This is very simple, like the names sound complicated, but it's really not. So let me see where perhaps it's best if I write here so that I can save them for later. So suppose we have a Euclidean three-manifold M. So then we can have the following objects on this manifold. We can have a vector field psi mu, a one-form eta, and a tensor phi mu nu. And if these three objects satisfy the following conditions, we'll say that there is an almost contact structure. So almost a contact structure. OK, so this means that the following relations have to be satisfied. So if we contract C with eta, we get 1. So that in particular, the vector field has to be non-vanishing on the manifold. And then phi mu nu times phi mu rho, that's equal to delta mu rho minus delta mu nu plus psi mu eta rho. So these are the two relations which the like define an almost contact structure. So from this relation, you can derive that phi has rank 2, and that the left and right kernels of phi are just given by xi and eta, so that eta times phi is equal to phi times xi is equal to 0. OK. Now, if I consider the subspace of the tangent space, which is orthogonal to eta, so we can call this subspace D. So these are the vectors such that x dot eta equals 0. So then this phi is actually, so if this phi restricted to this subspace D is a complex structure. And so this complex structure in principle can depend, can change as I move along this vector field psi. But if that does not happen, and this is the following requirement. So you multiply the tensor phi by the Lie derivative of itself along the xi direction. So when this object is equal to 0, then as a consequence, this complex structure does not change as I move along the vector field psi. And then this is called a transversely holomorphic foliation, where the leaves of the foliation are just given by the orbits of psi. So. So when such a structure is present, then we can prove that it is possible to cover the manifold in adapted coordinates, which have the following property. So so these coordinates, we'll call them tau, z, and z bar. And the property they satisfy is that psi is just given by d tau. This form eta is equal to d tau plus some function h, which can depend on z and z bar and tau times dz plus h bar dz bar. And phi has the following form. Minus. Okay. So in any in every patch, like eta and psi have the following form in coordinates. And what is interesting about these coordinates is that if I consider two such patches, then the transformations between the patches are given by the following. So tau prime is equal to tau plus some function t of z and z bar. And more importantly, z prime is just an holomorphic function of z. So in some sense, this transfers the holomorphic foliation is some sort of similar concept as like a complex structure in four dimensions. In four dimensions, if we have a complex structure, then we can introduce complex coordinates. And these coordinates are such that phi mu nu has like, well, a form similar to this. And the transition functions between complex coordinate patches are given by holomorphic functions. So in the same way, here we have this coordinate tau z and z bar, and z transform as so z transformed by holomorphic functions. Okay, so this is all what I wanted to say about transverse holomorphic foliation. The only other concept that we need is that of a compatible metric. So in the same way as for complex structure, there is the notion of an Hermitian metric, which is a metric which is compatible with the complex structure. Here we have the notion of a compatible metric. And this is a metric which satisfies the following requirement. So if we contract G with phi, this is equal to the metric itself minus eta alpha. Okay, so whenever there is a metric which satisfies this, it's called compatible. And we can write this metric in adapted coordinates. It has a very simple form. Let me see. I'll just write it here. So ds squared is equal to d tau plus h dz plus h bar dz bar squared plus c squared, where this function c can depend on tau z and z bar, times dz dz bar. OK. Yeah, so for instance we can write down, for instance, like the tree sphere, the round tree sphere using adapted coordinates, so that it's clear that indeed on the round tree sphere such a structure exists. Just where is everything? I don't think I need this. So as an example, we can take eta equals to d tau plus I over 2 1 plus absolute value square of z times z bar dz minus z dz bar, and the metric equals to eta squared plus let's see, the factors of 2. No factors of 2. Plus this. And you can check that this is a round tree sphere of unit radius if tau has periodicity 2 pi or, well, yeah, 2 pi. So in this case, tau runs along the op fiber, one op fiber of the tree sphere. And yeah, so this is the round metric. So from this metric, you can construct the SU2 times U1, the SU2 times U1 squash metric by just multiplying this. By just multiplying this factor by some numbers, which is not 1. Then the resulting metric does not have SO4 isometry, but just U1 times SU2. So in particular, this tells you that you can, well, I'm not going to say anything. Leave this comment for later. And this covers, does not cover all the sphere. It just covers everything except like one pole, and there is another coordinate patch which is just related by z prime is equal to 1 over z, and tau prime is equal to tau minus I over 2 log of z bar over z, which covers the other pole. Any question? Yes?
Do you have any dimension of ages? Some vector field?
The function h just goes into defining this. It's not really a function, because under, if you do a change of adapted coordinate, h changes. But yeah, it just goes into defining this one form eta.
I mean, if h is like, you know, in the background, at the torus vibration over the base, h is some vector field, which is like protection around some axis. So I wonder if you have any.
I'm not aware of any particular significance of this, but yeah, correct.
Looks like a generalization from your background.
Any other questions?
Here, the killing vector, is it a constant normal?
There is no killing vector.
What is this?
C is one vector, it's not killing. So all these coefficients can depend on tau, and xi is equal to d tau. So yeah, there is no killing vector. So there is no isometry corresponding to xi. So yes. So if, well, this is only something. So if there is a metric which is compatible, then indeed, one thing you can prove from this is that eta is just xi with lower indices, and yeah. So this implies that eta mu is just psi mu, psi mu, and then yes, psi is of constant norm. It's norm one because of this relation. Yeah. Well, no, but this is psi. I don't know. I mean, about A. I don't know what was his idea about H. Okay. So. Okay. So, given this longish introduction, I can now show how having a transversely holomorphic foliation with a compatible metric is actually a necessary and sufficient condition to solve these equations. But I'm not going to show the details, but I'm going to give you the idea. So if you look at this equation, it's simple to see that if zeta is 0 somewhere, then it's 0 everywhere on the manifold. So that means that if there is a non-trivial solution zeta, that has to be everywhere non-zero. So zeta is different than 0 everywhere. And then I can use zeta to construct psi in the following way. So psi mu is just equal to 1 over the absolute value of zeta times zeta dagger gamma mu zeta. So this is psi. Then eta is just going to be psi with lower indices. And phi is minus epsilon mu nu rho psi rho, which I can do because I am in three dimensions. And you can check that this psi, this phi, and the eta satisfy these equations. So they indeed determine an almost contact structure with a compatible metric, which is an almost contact metric structure. And finally, once you have this, you can use this equation again, and you can show that this condition here is satisfied. So you actually have a transversely holomorphic vibration. And okay, so now that you obtain that, you can go in reverse. You can assume that you have a transversely holomorphic foliation. Then you can work in coordinates, and you can find out what are the values of a mu, a h, and v, which solve this equation. And so I'm just going to write one or two of them just to give an idea. So v mu is equal to epsilon mu nu rho d nu eta rho plus kappa xi mu. Well, we can just write eta mu plus u mu. I'm going to define these objects in a second. H has some similar expression, and a mu. So these background fields are completely determined apart from this function kappa, which multiplies eta mu here and appears also somewhere else, and this vector u mu. And these objects have to satisfy the following constraint. So phi mu nu u nu has to be equal to minus I u mu. And also, there is this differential constraint that the object u mu plus kappa eta is conserved. So that means that given a certain transversely holomorphic foliation, the backgrounds which allow for supersymmetry for one supercharge, such that psi is given by this expression, are not completely determined. They are determined up to this arbitrariness in this vector field u and this function kappa. Okay, so one important thing, which is that if I consider a change of adapted coordinate, then I can show that, well, in the particular frame, then the spinor zeta transforms just by a phase, just takes a factor of f prime of z over f bar prime of z bar to the power 1/4 times c. And therefore, I can undo the effects of this change of coordinate patch by following it with a U1 transformation, because remember that Z has U1 charge 1, a U1R charge 1. And therefore, under this combination of holomorphic coordinate changes and U1R transformation, Z transforms as a scalar. So this is reminiscent of what happens in topological twisting of n equal to theories, for instance. In that case, we use the SU2R for twisting. Here, we just have a U1, but that's enough to make this Z a scalar under transformations of adapted coordinates. OK. Any question? Yes?
Would you get two patterns? You used a bigger off-shell gravity model.
Yeah, so if there, like, if you have a, if you couple the fields to like a bigger off-shell gravity multiple, then presumably you'll get more equations. And that's, you have more equations, more fields, but you would expect, from general grounds, I think you would expect the solution to be more restricted. And that's because basically the point is that you are forced to use the bigger multiplet if you have a theory which has a supercurrent which has more stuff in it. And that happens like if the theory is less generic. So the more specific your theory is, the shorter you can make the multiplet. So the more general your theory is, so presumably it can be put supersymmetrically on less manifolds, then like the more bigger the multiplet is. And you start with a theory with the same amount of supersymmetry?
Well, we can discuss it.
I think the general, and my general presumption in doing this is that if the theory is special, more special, then it can be put supersymmetrically on more manifolds. So for instance, if you take an n equal to theory, it's more special than n equal 1. Therefore, it can be put on more manifolds, preserving some supersymmetry. So for instance, in 4D, if you have a theory which has only the S multiplet, which has 16 components, it is less general than a theory with a U1R symmetry. So presumably, there are less solutions to the to this kind of equations. But right, I actually never did the classification for 16-16 supergravity in 4D. So I don't know if that's indeed the answer. OK. Oh, wow. OK, so let me see. Yeah, so like as for this equation here, it can be shown that it can always be, well, it gives rise to the following conditions. I don't know where to write it. Let me write it here. So we can define some object curly A, which is just given by this background gauge field mu plus I sigma eta. And then like this this equation here is satisfied provided that the tau z component of the field strength of curly A is 0. And d is given by some complicated expression. But in any case, this implies that this can always be solved by setting a mu equals to minus I sigma eta mu. Oops. OK. So in summary, the theory that we constructed depends on, well, depends on the choice of transversely holomorphic foliation. Then it can depend on the metric, which must be compatible with the transversely holomorphic foliation. Then it can, in principle, depend on this U and kappa. It can also depend on background gauge field as long as they satisfy this condition. And finally, it could depend on coupling constants and so on that I have in the theory for starting with. So what we find, I just can give you the result, and then I'll try to explain where it comes from, is that actually the dependence of on the metric, as long as I keep the transversely holomorphic foliation fixed, drops out. So the partition function does not depend on the metric, but only depends on the choice of transversely holomorphic foliation. And then, in a sense that I will define, the dependence on the background gauge fields is cohomological, as is the dependence on this U and kappa. Actually, in this case, we can say a little bit more. If the theory we start with allows for an FZ multiplet, then the dependence on U and kappa drops out completely. So the only theories for which there is dependence on U and kappa are theories with phi Etidiopoulos terms or real masses, or if the Taylor form of the target space is not exact. Okay, so in order to, so are there any questions so far? Okay, so in order to prove that, or to prove, to like give an idea of how, like, to prove this, I'll have to, unfortunately, give some more information about the deformations, how the deformations of this transversely holomorphic foliations work. I guess I could write it here. Well, but then no, I'll write it here so that all these relations are there to be seen. Okay, so we'll keep the sphere. Okay, so first of all, we can, given a transverse holomorphic foliation, we can define a projector pi in the following way. Okay, so this satisfies is a projector. And also, like xi and eta are the left and right kernels. So pi times eta equals pi xi equals 0. Okay, so this, given this projector, we can define what we call an holomorphic vector. So this is a vector x, so x in t 0, 1 of the manifold M. So that is x such that pi mu nu x nu is equal to x mu. And so in coordinates, it is given by xz times dz minus this function h d tau. And we also have the holomorphic 1, 0. Then we have holomorphic forms, omega in lambda 1, 0 of m. So this we define as the ones which have a similar property, but on the other side. Okay, so this is 1, 0. And the coordinate expression of this is very easy. Omega 1, 0 is just equal to omega 1, 0 z dz. So they only have a dz component. One thing you can check is that under a change of adapted coordinate, x and xz and omega z only transform in transforms in line bundles with holomorphic transition functions. So x prime z prime is equal to f prime z times x of z, and omega 1 0 z is equal to prime is equal to 1 over f prime of z times omega z. Okay. Okay, so now that we have defined lambda 1, 0, we can define the complement by just taking all the forms which are annihilated by pi. So those we will call forms in lambda 0, 1. So now this is a little bit strange because this space is one-dimensional. There is just stuff which is proportional to dz, but the 0, 1 forms as actually a two-dimensional bundle. So this, like in components, looks like omega tau times d tau plus h dz, and then there is an omega z bar times dz bar. Okay, so this is a weird splitting of the cotangent space, but it turns out to be useful. Clearly, one could also change the projector and put a plus here and then define other objects, which will, I mean, then there will be something proportional to dz bar here and something two-dimensional. Yeah, like there are different splittings that one can use, but this is a convenient one. And now, like, the important point is that we can consider the operator d, which sends like n forms in n plus 1 form, the usual external differentiation of a form. And we can check if it sends pq forms into a combination of p plus 1 q and pq plus 1 forms. So this is not, doesn't have to be the case. Actually, there is only one case which is non-trivial, which is the case of the 1, 0 form. So if I start with a 1, 0 form and I apply d, I could get a 1, 1 form, or like I could get a 0, 2 form. So there is no 2, 0 form because this lambda 1, 0 is one dimensional. So if I take the wedge product of 2, 1, 0 form, I get 0. So what I want to show is that if I start with a 1, 0 form and I take the external differential of it, I just get a 1, 1 form and I don't get a 0, 2 form. Well, that's just you take the expression of a 1, 0 form and like you apply the exterior differentiations and like you check that that's the case. It works. So there is no such a piece. This piece goes away. So then this property is true, and d sends this into a combination of these bundles. And if that's true, then we can define an operator d tilde, which is just defined in such a way that like it just takes this factor here. So d tilde sends pq into pq plus 1. So it's just the part of d which goes into this factor of the second summon. So by its definition, this d tilde satisfies the following property, which can be checked explicitly in coordinate if you want, but I mean, it's rather obvious. And therefore, I can consider the various like cohomologies. Like for instance, I can consider the cohomology of the d tilde operator. I can consider HPQ, which are just PQ forms, which are d tilde closed over d tilde exact. And well, so once we found out about this, we started looking at this cohomology and this d tilde operator, and we proved various facts. For instance, you can prove a Poincaré lemma for the d tilde operators, more or less as the d bar operator in complex geometry. And we argued that it was probable, plausible, that these cohomologies were indeed finite dimensional for compact manifolds. But then we actually found out that this transverse holomorphic foliations were studied in by mathematicians like a decade or a little bit more ago. And this is indeed a true fact. These cohomologies are finite dimensional if the manifold is compact. So, okay. Where did they put? Oh. Whoa. Okay. So let's see, where am I? This we did. Okay, right. Okay, so in how much time do I have? Like 5 minutes, 10 minutes? Okay, ooh, let's see what I can say in 10 minutes. So, okay, so I now define this operator d tilde, and that's all what I need to study the deformations of transverse holomorphic foliation, at least at the linearized level. So if you can choose one THF, so in coordinates it will be given by some choice of like h and like of h on the manifold, and then you can like study its deformations. So what you find out is that, so we now work in adapted coordinates for this reference transverse holomorphic foliation, and then the variations of psi mu, the variation of eta mu, and the variation of phi mu nu are restricted because they have to satisfy this equation that define the almost contact structure and this integrability condition here. So just by using everything except the integrability condition, we find out that the only independent quantities here are, well, delta xi mu remains. Here we just have delta eta z and delta eta z bar, because delta eta tau can be written in terms of the rest. And as for delta phi mu nu, the only components which we have to, that remains are delta z z bar and delta, well, z bar z. This is before using the integrability condition. Then we can use the integrability condition and see what happens if, like, what other property these variations must satisfy. And it's convenient to define an auxiliary quantity theta z. So this theta z is a 1,0 form, yes. So this is in lambda 1,0, but with coefficients in the holomorphic vector bundle over M. So I can write it down. So this guy is equal to minus 2i delta xi z times d tau plus h dz plus some funny combination. Okay, and it turns out that the linearization of this equation here is just d tilde of theta z is equal to 0. Okay, so theta z has to be delta tilde closed. Now, if I consider an infinitesimal diffeomorphism, so this will be parameterized by some vector field epsilon mu, then I can look at what happens to the transverse holomorphic foliation under a diffeomorphism. This should be a trivial change. And you can show that this gives rise to a delta, gives rise to a theta z, which is just d tilde of epsilon z. And therefore, like the non-trivial changes in the transverse holomorphic foliation are parameterized by the cohomology H1,0 of M with elements in T1,0 of M. So notice that this is well defined because under one of these changes of coordinates, this guy is an holomorphic vector, so it changes by an holomorphic function, which is annihilated by d tilde. So this like relations continue to be true in all patches. Okay. I can give just say what where did I have the sphere? Okay, so here we have the sphere. So for the sphere, you can like do some algebra. And what you find is that like you can try to find what this cohomology is. And what you find is that it's described by the following three possibility for delta xi z. So xi here is just equal to d tau, right? So there are three possibilities for delta xi z which satisfy, which are in this non-trivial cohomology. And these are given by the following three vector fields. One is z dz. The other one is z squared dz. And the final one is dz. And they can be multiplied by whatever complex number you want. So now these two are related by just changing patch by going from the south to the north pole. Also, for this change, this parameter gamma is faked because I can take it out by rescaling z. So we have like one branch of the moduli space, which is one complex dimension, and depends on this complex number gamma. And then we have some weird deformations of the transversely holomorphic foliations. So indeed, if you look, well, so then you can check that this, this number gamma, at least for deformations around the round sphere, indeed corresponds to this parameter beta b, which appears in the partition function that were computed using localizations. So this. Like, so we can say that this B describes like the choice of transverse holomorphic foliation, at least around the round case. Actually, this can be also extended like to be far away from the round case. Okay, so now, okay, so the example of the sphere is done. So, right, so the final thing I wanted to say was like, okay, so now that we have all this, we can try to understand what does the partition function of one of this theory depend on. And so the idea is to use the fact that Q is a scalar under some combination of changes of coordinates which are adapted to the transverse holomorphic foliation and the U1R symmetry. So for theories which have like a supercharge which is a scalar, if one can prove that the in flat space the energy momentum tensor is Q exact, then that's enough to, well, then there is an unwieldy argument by which like the theory should be topological. And that's basically because all the Siegel terms that you have to add in order to couple the theory to like curved space are also going to be Q exact by virtue of Q being a scalar. So in this case, this is, in our case, this is, we don't really have so much because our Q is just a scalar under this changes of coordinates which are adapted. But this should be enough to show that like if the energy momentum tensor, or better, if the deformation of the theory around flat space is Q exact, then I can change the metric without changing the transverse holomorphic foliation, so that like I can just consider this kind of coordinate changes, and that should be enough to like show that like the partition function does not depend on the choice of adapted metric. Then once I have the fact that the partition function does not depend on the adapted metric, I can take the manifold as big as I want. And then like the analysis around flat space should be enough because like the manifold is almost flat. So there is a better way to do this, which does not rely on this unwavy argument, but like it requires more work. It requires basically to like define very precisely what this, like some sort of twisted version of this theory, and to show that indeed in the twisted version, that the twisted version, the partition function does not depend on the choice of adapted metric. But if you just work around flat space, then you can look at how the Lagrangian changes when I do a change in transverse, when I do a change of metric and a change of transverse holomorphic foliation, or a change of this, well, indeterminate U and kappa that I had in the vector fields, in the backgrounds. And what you find out is that the change in the Lagrangian around flat space is given by a Q-exact piece, which like shouldn't change the partition function, plus something which depends on delta psi z, and something which depends on time sum operator, and something which depends on delta phi zz bar, which multiplies some other operator. So by virtue of how we constructed this Lagrangian, it is supersymmetric. And indeed, you can check that if this delta xi z and delta phi zz bar are such that this object satisfies this equation, then indeed the Lagrangian is supersymmetric. So that's a check. Also, like, because we started from Lagrangian, which is diffeomorphic, which is invariant under diffeomorphism, clearly if theta is equal to d tilde of something, then it better be that that these terms rearrange into a Q-exact term, and indeed that happens. And finally, and therefore, what you have is that this this like dependence on this like delta xi z and delta phi zz bar is only through this cohomology h 1 comma 0 with values in t 1 comma 0 of m, because like the only things that appear here are delta xi z and delta phi zz bar, and there is no appearance of delta eta, which means h, or of this function c, which appears in the metric. So basically, this tells you that, well, if you buy this argument about the fact that it's enough to look at what happens around flat space, this tells you that like the partition function only depends on the choice of almost of transverse holomorphic foliation through theta z. Actually, you can say more. There is no appearance of the complex conjugate of theta z. So the dependence on the on the transverse holomorphic foliation moduli should be holomorphic. And yeah, I think I will stop here, as I don't think I have any more time. I can say, I can tell you one simple thing, which is if you consider the squash sphere of Amos, Omich, and Lee, that corresponds to keeping the same THF. So you have this sphere, you have this parameter gamma, but you just change the metric. You don't change the choice of transverse holomorphic foliation. That is that you keep psi equals to d tau and like eta equal to this thing here, and then like by this argument you will say that like the partition function computed by Amos, Omich, and Lee should be the same as on the round sphere, which it is. Then you can look at what Imamura and Imamura does. So Imamura also considers this metric, but actually if you look carefully like at what are the supercharges that it defines, the choice of vector C is not just d tau, it's something more complicated. So it is actually changing the transversely holomorphic foliation. If you want, it's basically taking this vector field to be d tau plus some other piece of a killing vector on this base, if I remember correctly. basically some piece which like rotates Z and Z bar. And you can work out that indeed this corresponds to deforming the transverse seromorphic foliation of the round case in this way, and therefore it should like correspond to changing B. And then you can consider all sorts of other squash spheres that people have constructed, and you can show that they always fall off in this kind of deformation of the round case. These deformations are more weird, and nobody has ever computed anything on like some on a manifold which with this choice of transverse seromorphic foliation. Unfortunately, these only preserve one super. It's not with this kind of transverse seromorphic foliation. It's possible to solve for two supercharges. With this one, it's only possible to solve for one. So presumably, it's more complicated. But then yeah, the answer could, in principle, be something different. Yes.
So for the sphere, it's easy.
The modular space has like one branch, which is one complex dimension. This is what you see here around the origin, but you can actually make it. It's actually done in the mathematical literature. It's mapped out, and then there are some other points which are not in the same branch of the modular space. So then you can also look at S2 times S1. And over there, there are basically two different classes of transverse seromorphic foliation, in one case, you just they correspond to deformations of just taking psi to be along the S1. That's like natural. You just take the psi along the S1 of the S2 times S1, and then you can deform that. And I think there is a one complex dimensional modular space of deformation of this thing. But there is another choice, which is more complicated, and it's disconnected from this one. This I cannot remember, like, what, how big the I think it's also one complex. What's that?
You can also do Riemann surfaces
Okay, Riemann surfaces. So you can do So this is another question. It's like which manifolds allow for a transverse seromorphic foliation. So there is a classification which I don't claim to understand, but I think basically it's either ciphered or it's some kind of T2 bundle over S1.
Why isn't the trivial Riemann surface
Riemann surface circle, I think, is.
That's an example of a cipher
map. Cipher is more general than that. And then there is like this T2 bundles over S1, which, yeah. But there is a classification that's been worked out.
And the Tinderbush function is an homomorphic function, or a section of some bundle?
No, we think it's an holomorphic. Well, it can have singularities, but yeah, we think it's just an holomorphic function of the on the modular space. So for instance, like the partition function on the tree sphere is an holomorphic function of B. Well, apart from singularities.
Any other questions? Let's think.